Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to keep unfolding the library of consciousness and culture. You know how sometimes images can be as informative or suggestive as concepts or words. And I remember a long time ago, and I think like a lot of people, I've puzzled and been sort of struck in an imaginative as well as conceptual way about the double helix structure of DNA, this marvelous twisting echoed strand that encodes or helps produce life on this planet. And, you know, like a lot of people, I noticed some interesting things about that image. You know, when you think with images as opposed to thinking with concepts, you follow connections in a different way. And one of the things I remember noticing is like, wow, that sure looks a lot like the caduceus, that weird twisty staff that God Hermes wields in Greek lore and that, you know, eventually became the sort of symbol of the medical profession. And, you know, he also shows up in the, you know, the company that sold flowers or whatever, you know, the basic idea of a messenger. And Hermes is a god of information, of messages, of flitting between here and there. And it seemed like an odd kind of resonance, you know. And then another one that people often noted, and myself as well, was how much this helix structure, this twisting strand, resembled a coiled serpent. And indeed, there seemed to be something powerful there because he started to go into the lore of the serpent. And it was, you know, in many cultures, it's a powerful symbol of life itself, sometimes in a positive way and sometimes in a negative way. It's almost the kind of, you know, the lower serpentine realm that in some Gnostic cosmologies is escaped through, you know, the higher realms of gnosis and mystical transcendence. So it has this weird ambivalence, but it's, and still there's this strange coiling thing going on. And I think, like a lot of people, I was really blown away in the mid-90s when the anthropologist Jeremy Narby came out with The Cosmic Serpent, in which he talked about this image and he talked about the connection between the serpent and the double helix. But he made a very interesting argument. He's an anthropologist who's done a tremendous amount of work, both political, economic work and studies in the Amazon. And he thought that the links between argued that the links between DNA and the kind of serpent image were no joke, and that in fact part of what we see in the ayahuasca trance, at least as it's used by traditional shamans, is actually a kind of interface between a larger informational body of natural wisdom of the thought of plants, essentially, and the human imagination and the human subject. You know, there's always been this question of how these folks figured out that, you know, you take a couple of plants out of this vast, vast library of fauna, flora, I should say, in the Amazon, and, you know, whip them together in just the right way, and you can produce this amazing experience, which, of course, as he points out, many shamans say actually gives them information about plants. And that's a pretty wacky idea on some from a scientific secular perspective, But here was somebody making it who really knew his science and really knew his secular perspectives. And it's a fascinating book that goes like a little bit farther than a very careful, nervously careful scientist would do. And yet it has a very powerful resonance and certainly inspired a lot of imagination and was a controversial and very sort of productive intervention into the language of ayahuasca in particular. And Narbi went on to write another book about intelligence in nature, which kind of carried this idea further, which is how is there an intelligence, conceptual language or a informational language that's in nature and that somehow different kinds of organisms and ant colonies are actually kind of informational entities as well, which in some ways can speak to us across this apparent, eternal gap between human minds and the world at large. So I'm very happy to have Jeremy on the show today, and we can talk about these books and his new book as well, or recent book, the Psychotropic Mind, which is a trialogue actually between Jeremy Narbi and Jan Koonin and Vincent Ravalek, and a fascinating discussion. And the only thing negative about that book that I've heard is that Jeremy Narbi doesn't talk enough in it. So that tells you something about how interesting he is and how interested people are in him. But before we bring Jeremy on, I want to introduce, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, the lovely Maja Daou, White Witch of L.A. How's it going?
Hi,
Maja.
I'm good. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. And you're doing pretty good out there. I read a little bit right up in the L.A. Weekly about the witch show, and that seemed to be pretty provocative thing you did there.
It was good. It was fun. One of the things we talked about was how the connection between witchcraft and shamanism, which all kind of related to Jeremy's books and his influence. And it was funny because, I first read, I'm a big Cosmic Serpent fan myself, and I also read his other book, Intelligence in Nature. And when I first read Cosmic Serpent, I was studying a lot about shamanism and healing because the witch event, I kind of focused on the healing aspect that the lore of witchcraft gets into. And, I had studied biochemistry and was reading about shamanism and was learning about the I Ching. And like you said, I'd noticed like the double helix in a lot of the imagery in I Ching, which came from Chinese shamans. And so it was at that same time that I came across the cosmic serpent. So it was very synchronistic for me because I was already kind of looking at this, shamanistic link between DNA and then also this imagery that was kind of utilized. So for me, the cosmic serpent came around at just the right time. So I was totally delighted that there was someone's brain was working that way and kind of just spilled it all open for me. It was great.
Well, wonderful. Well, we can bring that brain on right now. So, Jeremy, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Well, hi, folks. I'm purring listening to you guys.
Oh, good.
What about you're calling from Switzerland, where you live?
Yep, purring in Switzerland. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I'm really curious. I mean, you got a serious academic background. You studied history. You got your doctorate in anthropology from Stanford, and all of that lore, that learning, that scholarly care went into the cosmic serpent, but it went sort of farther than I think a lot of people in your boat would go. And I'm kind of curious about that. Like, how did that book kind of come out of your research, and how did you decide to sort of, explore these sort of more unusual possibilities in terms of the connection between DNA and the ayahuasca experience and the image of the serpent?
Well, thanks for the question, and there's a couple of parts to the answer. One kind of academic part would be if you've read Thomas Kuhn's History of the Structure of Scientific Revolutions, that it's people who are at the limits of the paradigm and who are questioning the current consensus that make the breakthroughs. So you want to go to that place where there is not consensus, and you want to ask the difficult questions that are taboo, and it's by doing that and by challenging the overall consensus that major breakthroughs have happened. So that's where the big game lies. You necessarily have to kind of break ranks and go where no one else has been. The other thing is, I was inspired by rock, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, etc. I wanted something that was a little bit dissonant and that was new and that it would be, what's that sound? And then the third element was, having lived with Amazonian people for a couple of years in the middle of the 1980s, just out of respect for these people, just simply trying to take seriously what they said. And they said all this kind of, outlandish stuff to us Westerners, but it was painfully obvious that us Westerners who'd grown up in suburbs and been to university libraries didn't know anything about surviving in the rainforest. And this is the most biodiverse place in the world, and these people say that their vast knowledge about the plants around them comes from the plants themselves. So, one can either just say, that's a metaphor, and dismiss it as superstition, and which seems to me pretty kind of impolite. Or if you've made friends with these people and take them seriously as individuals, say, maybe these people have a point of view or something that I don't understand because of my own limitations. What if they were actually onto something, and because of our own presuppositions, we didn't know about it? And it seemed like just a sort of basic intercultural politeness to consider that maybe we had limitations and that maybe they were onto something. So roll all that together, and it sort of sent me on that track.
So I like the idea that part of the motivation is your own kind of rock and roll sensibility, and that always struck me as there's so many marvelous books that have influenced me, Cosmic Serpent definitely being among them, that they've been powerful partly because they clearly are rooted, on the one hand, in a more academic, deeply researched, historically and scientifically informed, anthropologically self-aware perspective, and yet they see that point, that edge that you're talking about, where something is suggested that really resonates powerfully, and yet in order to articulate it, on some level you've got to let some things go. You have to say, well, look, like, those are important questions, but this is important as well. And I'm kind of curious, like, is it that your connections with the people and your experience of the place sort of ineluctably drew you into that more ambiguous realm, or it's just kind of always been in your temperament to push things a little bit far?
No, actually, I guess I could confess to being a bit of a scaredy cat. I mean, I'm no Indiana Jones by any means. And when I first came onto the ayahuasca mystery, I mean, I kind of chickened out and turned my back on it. It was so, I had, four experiences, two of which were major ones, and one of which I included in the first chapter of Cosmic Serpent. They were kind of hair-raising and in contradiction to my whole world view and most of Western philosophy, it seemed. And perhaps even to obtaining a doctorate in anthropology from Stanford University. So I thought, the shadow of Carlos Castaneda was floating all over the place. This was the mid-1980s, and it was just not cool to talk about hallucinogens at that point, and certainly not to take them seriously. So I turned my back on it, went back and wrote a doctorate where the word ayahuasca was hardly mentioned, and then became an activist for the rights of indigenous Amazonian people with a small Swiss organization for a bunch of years. And it was by doing that work outside of the academy, fundraising and project supervision and working with indigenous organizations in the Peruvian Amazon in the early 1990s, doing land titling and really concrete stuff, that really drove it home to me. This is no longer just an academic game and a thing about publishing dissertations or what have you. It wasn't about reading committees and careers. It was about real people trying to survive in difficult circumstances and rainforests being cut down and finding budgets and getting them respected and getting land titles emitted and this kind of stuff. And actually, these Indians were serious customers. And it was seeing that year after year that finally led me to say, well, look, wait a second. We can't just go on using these people's knowledge about plants and never once consider what they mean when they say that their knowledge about plants comes from the plants themselves.
I love that was your perspective and that it was through your experience that kind of broke your head out of that non-reality university publishing, like, let's all write books about it, because it's like you said, it's impolite. And what Western science would do is they would take all the plants from the shamans and develop them into medicine. And when scientists and ethnobotanists wanted new cures for something, where would they go? They would go on these missions down into the jungle and literally steal it from the shamans, while at the same time laughing at the methodologies that the shamans said they actually found the medicine through. So I love that you actually were able to, like, break out of that kind of environment and mindset that you were in the middle of by actually seeing, tracing it back to the source and saying, well, wait, like, they're all using all this medicine anyway in science and isolating the chemicals and then making it, claiming that it's scientific, but they actually just, like, heisted it from the shamans that said they got it from the plants and then laughed at them. So I thought that was, like, a really big revelation that people needed to hear.
Well, thanks, and I agree with you. There's just one irony there, which is having then done that, I went ahead and wrote a book, you know.
And then
the book actually did well, and it's been, relative to other anthropology texts, relatively a bestseller, you know. So it goes to show. You know, you say, okay, I don't want to publish books. I don't want to be an academic. I want to be an activist. I'm going to take these people seriously. You go charging down that alley, you finally end up publishing a book, and there you are, you know. But sometimes some books are more kind of like enzymes than others.
That's a good way of putting it. So what kind of stuff, what did it help produce in its reaction to the world outside, particularly in the Amazon or amongst, you know, Brazilians or Peruvians studying the Amazon? I mean, on the kind of North American side, it was a sort of predictable split between, you know, the scientists who would just kind of ignore it and say, oh, this is not proven, and, you know, it's a nice little fantasy, and, you know, and then the people who are more independent thinkers and people interested in ayahuasca, for whom it's a very important book, a powerful book, because it does suggest, you know, actual pragmatic and, you know, larger cosmic connections between, our minds and the world outside of us. This sort of, you know, Kantian gap is leaped over through the medium of this amazing plant phenomenology. But how did people closer to home, so to speak, respond to the book?
Closer to home, you mean?
I meant in terms of the origins of the story, in terms of the Amazon.
Oh, the people in the Amazon. Well, it's taken me years to be able to get to a place where I can actually answer this question fairly easily, because I kind of took the whole thing, so seriously or something, but or like it was still part of me. But it's been 16 years since I published it. So it's easier to sort of look back and comment as if it were, something that's passed already. I was afraid initially that the indigenous people wouldn't like it. You know, like, who is this, white kid who's suddenly, associating our, shamanic view of the world with DNA? You know, how dare he, and so on. I mean, but actually, I didn't meet an indigenous person who was not delighted by it. And, you know, they understood immediately that by juxtaposing what they were saying with what cutting-edge molecular biologists were saying, it was actually a way of making their knowledge about nature understandable to Westerners. And they also knew that that was politically important. So And that was clear right off the bat. I mean, one of the first things I did was have the book translated into Spanish and make it available to the indigenous organizations and people and thinkers and individuals and healers in South America. And, you know, so that was really cool. Meanwhile, back in the Western world, it's a bit of a long story, but I mean, the shorter version is, I mean, anthropologists have kind of ignored it, and, you know, it's sort of, I don't know why, they would have to ask them, but it wasn't even reviewed, you know, in American Anthropologist or whatever. I've heard important anthropologists, you know, when asked about it, say things like, oh, that is not anthropology. You know, so we don't even have to comment on it. Meanwhile, biologists were kind of interested. And more individual biologists, I was surprised by this. It's like, so we're talking about double helix and these hallucinating shamans are talking about these twisted serpents, but there might be a connection via animate essences. Actually, I found the biological scientists to be more open-minded than at least I thought they'd be. Then there have been surprises, like, because it's ended up interesting a whole bunch of different kinds of people, you know, midwives or ethnopsychiatrists or, you know, that kind of category. I think that more broadly, I just got really lucky riding the wave of interest in ayahuasca. I mean, frankly, when I was writing the book between 93 and 95, there were very few people who'd even heard of ayahuasca. And then in the second half of the 90s, it kind of became the new drug or the drug of the times. I mean, drug is a strange word, but still. I think it was Daniel Pinchbeck who said that what LSD was to the 60s, ayahuasca is to now. But when I was writing the book, it wasn't like that at all. I mean, you know, people didn't even know how to pronounce it. So then it became one of those books that when ayahuasca suddenly got the interest of the global world, and all these kind of international northerners, westerners, easterners started trying it, then how do you make sense of it? Well, you look at the books that have tried to make sense of it. And I think that Cosmic Serpent is one of the books that allows people to sort of, you know, tiptoe into the subject and think about its implications.
Well, and that, one of the things I really liked about the implications of it that I felt would reach more people, I mean, the anthropologists, I guess, are just kind of stinkers, but that it asks the question, how do we know things, right? And, I mean, the inclusion of drugs may have put some people off, but, I mean, we all know Francis Crick and Watson were on drugs when they even discovered DNA in the first place. So I think your book so well illustrates what is the origin of biological knowledge. Like, what does it mean that these shamans know the same things that the biologists are discovering? And maybe that's what turned a lot of people in the scientific community on a little more, is because they would actually see those connections and see, well, like, oh yeah, how do we know this again, and how would they know that, like, what, how is that happening? So it kind of makes a scientist, I would hope, think how we get to these breakthroughs. And like you said, it's usually by going off the path, by going a taboo route, by kind of breaking apart from some other way. And I think that the implications of your book that might have touched different communities is calling in that question of a source of the knowledge that we can get to from these different avenues.
Well, two things that I'd say to add just to what you said is that when the book came out, I was surprised to find that it was regularly described as a drug book. And, you know, I had not thought that I'd written a book about drugs. It was a book about different things, including indigenous people's knowledge and molecular biology and their possible interface and the limits of rationalism, et cetera. And, you know, maybe 5% of the book was about drugs, but that made it a drug book. But that said, I think that a lot of different individual scientists have done a lot for bringing what are called drugs, but we could call them, you know, psychoactive substances or plants to the awareness of the international community. And one thing about ayahuasca, I mean, no one has said this is hogwash. You know, in other words, this is stuff that if you drink it, nothing happens. In fact, if you're a scientist and you doubt what is claimed about ayahuasca by, for example, indigenous Amazonian people, you can drink the stuff and see for yourself if you dare. You know, no one, to my knowledge, no scientist has said, I've drunk the stuff and I saw nothing, therefore this is a worthless argument.
Right.
You know, actually, we're still waiting for the scientific brigade and all the sheriffs to show up and so that we can have them taste the medicine.
Well, didn't you have some interest from biologists that you facilitated
I'm speaking not just out of my hat here. I mean, I've actually, you know, been fishing for scientists for the last, 14 years to test the idea, but... And to take scientists who are doing research in domains like molecular biology to come and check it out. And the thing is that the preliminary results of that is that, yes, scientists can get new ideas, information about the research that they're conducting in these modified states of consciousness using ayahuasca and Amazonian shamans to guide them. But it's not simple. Combining science and shamanism is not a simple thing by any means. It's like they're radically different methodologies. I mean, you know, it's the ayahuasca method goes through the subjective consciousness of the researcher, and it cannot be an objective experience. You know, so it's kind of like the contrary of what science is supposed to be. You know, so science is supposed to be objective.
Do you have the sense that there are, that there's obviously a different way of accessing knowledge in the ayahuasca situation, but that it can have connections with what we would think of as scientific knowledge? Explain that difference.
What I compare it to is like if you have a football game and you have the main angle of where the camera is filming from, then you have the reverse angle on the other side and you see the same play from a reverse angle and things look different. They look like they're going the other way, in fact. But sometimes you see things in the same particular moment that you don't see from the other angle. And so the angles are actually complementary. You know, so yes, scientists and shamans are looking at the same reality. They're looking at how to cure people. They're looking at which substances and plants to use to help people get better. And then they have completely, you know, some people are looking through microscopes and other people are modifying their consciousness and examining their visions. But, and these are just complementary approaches to the same reality, which is life on Earth, you know?
Yeah, we had Jim Fadiman on the show, a couple of, a month and a half or so.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that when he said that too, Eric.
And you know, he was talking about LSD research that he was involved in the 1960s and how they were really focused on practical results, bringing in architects, scientists, people who were working with complex problems, and they were asked to bring their problem to the session. And he said there were remarkable effects, particularly when they were very complicated situations, because there's something about, even stepping aside just from ayahuasca in particular, there's clearly something about the psychedelic state that allows a kind of complexity to be organized and revealed, whether it's the complexity of perception, of cognitive operations, or of the natural world. There's a kind of way of engaging complexity that has, in his experience and firm conviction, very positive effects. So it's kind of not that hard on some level to imagine this, you know, sort of amplification of mind, which engages a greater degree of complexity, which resonates with the complexity in nature. I mean, it's no accident that you're in the Amazon, this incredibly overpoweringly rich environment of DNA doing its thing.
Yeah, well, and also it's been documented even in the 90s. There's a book called The Art of Scientific Investigation that was published in 1950 that shows that almost all the major scientific breakthroughs did not come at moments when the scientists were in front of the blackboard scratching their heads. It came after months of doing that and not finding the answer, and then defocalizing by going for a walk or cooking or shaving or taking a bath, eureka, et cetera. I mean, Carrie Mullis discovered the PCR reaction in tripping. I mean, you know, quite simply. It doesn't mean to say that anybody who's going to take LSD is going to discover something major, but if you have your mind as a scientist filled with the problem at hand, and you spend months at it, and this is what this book in the 1950s showed. There's a period of kind of there's saturation, incubation, and then illumination. So you saturate yourself with the problem until you're banging your head against the wall, and then you just have to you incubate it for some time, and then suddenly you let your mind go one way or another, a bingo, the breakthrough comes.
Wonderful. And, well, we're going to have to take a brief break here. This is Eric Davis on Expanding Mind. We're talking with Jeremy Narby, and we'll be right back after these announcements.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis and Jeremy Narby. And we've been talking about plants and snakes and drugs and all that fun stuff. Before the break, we were kind of talking about inception of discovery and how we know things. And Jeremy, I love what you were saying about Carrie and just how we figure things out by, I'm getting more and more convinced as I get older that we only know anything through abandonment and surrender. And I always think about the Hanged Man tarot card and the story of Odin and how he had to hang himself upside down from a tree in order to figure something out. It's like you have to totally shift your perspective and just allow it to come in. And that reminded me of your other book, which I wanted to mention too, that I loved, which was Intelligence in Nature, where you do also kind of investigate this, how we come to knowledge and how there is consciousness in nature. And I actually had a personal question for you about that book. I was wondering, it reminded me of this other book of mine that's one of my favorites that Peter Tompkins wrote. Of course, Peter Tompkins got famous for The Secret Life of Plants. And I was curious if you ever read his book, Secret Life of Nature, because he talked about some things that were sort of similar that you brought up in your book.
There's The Secret Life of Plants, right? But then you say there's a book called The Secret Life of Nature?
Yeah, it came out posthumously, actually. It was published after he died, and it was the last book that he had been working on towards the end of his life.
No, I haven't even heard of it, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting to me just because in that book, Peter Tompkins goes into an investigation of how we see nature spirits. Like, he gets into the theosophists and how they kind of categorize the devas and, you know, all of the fairies. And then he connects it back to science through looking at quantum physics and quarks and how that consciousness displayed through fairies gets translated into science. So it's sort of that crossover of ancient thinking into consciousness revealed. But what inspired you to put that book together?
Oh, Intelligence in Nature?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the writing The Cosmic Serpent was, almost like a blow to my certitudes about the world, a blow to my education. I realized that my presuppositions were arrogant and one-sided. And finally, just by seeing all the correspondences between what shamans say and what scientists say, allowing myself to put the two visions together and juxtaposing them. What I could see by, like, putting the two maps together was that if the one thing was sure, it was, as shamans say, that there is intelligence in nature. That means in individual plants, animals, and in all living beings around us. And that this view, this kind of Western materialist, secular, irrationalist view that essentially the world around us is inert and that it's there for us to use, could well be wrong, quite simply.
Mm.
I wanted, at that point, it seemed, meanwhile, you take DNA seriously. DNA, if you take what scientists say about it seriously, is a kind of a text, a chemical text in every single cell. So how could this nature around us just be inert and somehow kind of stupid and devoid of intention and intelligence? It didn't even make sense on the face of it. And, you know, I rush to say I'm not a creationist, I'm an agnostic and a Marxist by training. If DNA is a chemical text and if the twisted serpent is related to animate essences and you put two and two together, what that spells is that nature is full of intelligence, and not with a capital I, like floating above the planet in a masculine form with a long white beard, but inside each and every cell, if not DNA molecule.
From that book, what would you say was the best sort of example that showed you another model or another, you know, a part of nature which shows the kind of deeper intelligence that you're gesturing towards?
Well, there's a whole bunch of them. Take a single-celled slime mold for a second, will you? This is like a giant single cell that is a blob-like organism that swarms over and engulfs its food. Not exactly a prime candidate of intellectual achievement, but when Japanese scientists put this organism, which is halfway between an amoeba and a mushroom, I mean, it kind of defies categories even, it can actually solve a maze quite quickly. It spreads out and covers all the corridors of the maze, but when you put food at the entrance and exit of the maze, it shrinks its body down to form a tube that spans the shortest distance between the two food sources, and it solves the maze this way. It manages to calculate the shortest distance between the entrance and the exit of the maze. How a single cell does this is not known, but that it does this has been established in the last 10 years. You know, so here is a single cell blob that can figure something out like a labyrinth. So now what do we do?
Now what do we do? Well, it's so important because it's literally, Jeremy, this is healing the schism that has been in humanity since Descartes. I mean, somehow Descartes managed to make us think that something only has intelligence if it has a centralized nervous system with a brain. And even then, not even animals with centralized nervous systems with a brain necessarily have intelligence. Right? They can, which, you know, of course, Noam Chomsky said my favorite thing, which is animals aren't intelligent because they don't have syntax, you know, mm-hmm. Right? So, but that it's being able to conceive that a single cell has intelligence is starting to unravel that block that was started from Descartes trying to separate those two. And that, to me, the realization of that is what is kind of healing that gigantic rift that's been in science for hundreds of years.
Well, thanks for pointing it out, but and I would add that what considering this stuff is also requires, in my opinion, is being attentive to the words we use, because we do come out of a Judeo-Christian and now rationalist cultural tradition, and words like intelligence and even words like nature are completely loaded. For example, if you look at the definitions that have been given of intelligence, they are almost exclusively in human terms and cannot be applied to other species by definition. That's because Western cultures have put such a prime on being human that it was long said that intelligence was a human specificity and that everybody else was stupid, essentially. And then as such, because it was supposed to be one of the human treasures, people fought over the definition, so that there's now a proliferation of definitions, all of them in exclusively human terms. And at this point, it's probably not very intelligent to try to define it any further. But that kind of leaves us, when you do have a single-celled slime mold that solves a maze, well, then what do you say? You can't use the word intelligence because it's not human. But then, so then what do you, you know, we're kind of stuck in no man's land conceptually. Meanwhile, nature is also, when you go to the, nature, if you look at the definition in the dictionary, is defined in opposition to culture, and it's everything that is not human, in fact. It's the phenomena of the physical world to the exclusion of humans and human creations. That's the definition. And so when you go to the Amazon and you speak with indigenous people who live in nature, and you say, you know, what is your concept for everything that is not human? They say, what? and you say, yeah, everything that's around, all around us here, the plants, the animals, and you put it all together, and it's that which is not human. What's your word? And they say, no, we don't have a word for that. We consider that, in fact, everything is human. And that shamans, when they take ayahuasca and tobacco, their eyes see clearly, and what they see is the human inside all the plants and animals, and that's why we say that we're all one family. So yeah. Nature is a concept made by people who have cut themselves off from nature. And so just using that word is buying into the division that you were just mentioning. So in other words, as Westerners,
I love that idea
condemned to use Western words like intelligence and nature, but they have their kind of hidden baggage in them.
Well, I'm curious about how these thoughts have played themselves out as you work in a very concrete political way with indigenous communities in the Amazon over, you know, intellectual property rights, over, you know, incoming oil companies. I mean, in a way, your experience with the, you know, the very hard realities of indigenous life in Amazon right now, they kind of resonate with some of these other more abstract ideas about the nature of Western prejudice and scientific blindness. So how has that evolved over the years? Because you've been, I mean, that's mostly what you've been doing for such a long time.
Yeah.
And they clearly interrelate.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not exactly sure what to compare it to, but I consider myself lucky to have my hands, well, it's kind of like making bread, touching the dough, involved with day-to-day struggles of people. And, yeah, oil companies and resisting oil companies and just dealing with the messy reality of the Amazon in the 21st century, it fills up my days with reports and accounts, and even if I've been working for an NGO for 21 years that tries to back indigenous organizations as they try to survive the onslaught, and yes, there's money for this kind of thing. You know, I oversee something like $400,000 a year worth of projects for different indigenous organizations, and you know, it's complicated, and as Bob Dylan said, money doesn't talk, it swears. And when oil companies come in, there's corruption and there's all kinds of stuff that goes on. So, and that's a long way away from the concepts that we were just talking about. And, you know, to a certain extent, there's a frustration, which is, well, I haven't written a book for the last 7 years. There have been some personal reasons in there, but it's also just because I'm busy doing my desk job, and my desk job is that kind of activist stuff. But I think that by being grounded in that kind of ongoing, evolving reality, which is political and messy and ecological and economic and all of that all together, it's really good as an intellectual to be grounded in that. I think to it's kind of like having a finger on the pulse of what's really going on. Meanwhile, there is this thirst for ayahuasca, indigenous shamanism, knowledge of the Amazon that has been developing really fast. Almost just like the oil companies and the gold extractors and the logging companies and all of this stuff has been getting stronger, the interest of other Westerners for the ecological shamanic thing has been getting stronger. So it's all kind of going on at the same time, and I'm happy not to have gone off the deep end and not to be into too much of a new age thing. And actually, you know, if anybody comes and says, so, you know, what are you up to 16 years after writing about the ayahuasca thing? Oh, well, sorry, I'm just involved with helping people survive in difficult circumstances, you know. So there it is. And then finally, I don't know, you know, the muses, they give you a telephone call and they say, boy, I want you to write another book. And they did that to me twice with Cosmic Serpent and Intelligence in Nature. And since then, they've been kind of letting me get on with it. So I've just been taking notes, reading all kinds of things that I find interesting when I have the chance, and otherwise, you know, keeping on, keeping on. And but I'm ready to get that call any day now.
That's a wonderful perspective. I'm curious, though, just in a, we don't have that, we just got a few minutes left, but if you could give us a little sense, at least in terms of your work desk, a little sense of like what the big dynamics are right now in the Amazon. I mean, the situation in some ways, you know, it's the same characters have been, you know, fighting it out for a while now, but you know, especially as we're so inundated with information, it's hard to keep up. So what are you seeing now in terms of both rising threats and rising possibilities from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, my perspective is probably distorted because I've been focusing exclusively on the Peruvian Amazon, and that's really kept me busy. And it's a place where things have been kind of exacerbated. So what I might report may be a little bit extreme, and you wouldn't want to generalize it across all of South America. But the last 5 years in Peru, there's been this ultra-liberal government, which has considered that everything is for sale, including the subsoil, including mountains, including rivers. I mean, they haven't started selling the air we breathe yet, but I was surprised they didn't think of it. And this means that, for example, the considerable land rights that indigenous people obtained in the last 25 years, some of which with, you know, funding that I raised, the government came along and said, well, sorry, but that doesn't include the subsoil, and we're selling off these concessions. I mean, I think now 90% of the Peruvian Amazon subsoil is owned by oil companies. Mm. And 75% of that was in the last 5 years. So, and then once a company owns the subsoil, they can do what they want. They can come in and, you know, do seismic routes and put dynamite down there and start drilling, and then there's spills, and you know, some of the stuff we've been doing is like it's not even Band-Aids. It's working with people so they go with GPS and camera and simply document the damage. You know, it's been I don't know, what do you call it, just going into areas and kind of in polluting them and extracting them, and it's been wanton, I think, is the word. You know.
Yeah, well, I'm curious. You know, that's obviously a hard thing to watch year and year after year after year, and to fight against, and to see your efforts, you know, fail sometimes, often. And I'm curious, what kind of keeps you going in that situation? A lot of people get burned out doing that kind of work.
No, You know, actually, as a kind of born optimist, I'll tell you one thing that started getting to me recently is that, so Peru has been selling all of this oil, all this copper and gold and silver, and et cetera, and, you know, the prices have been rising and all of that. And so Peru is no longer a poor country. It's a middle-income country. And so, at least that's how it's classified. And so all these NGOs, Oxfam and so forth, have been pulling out. They can't justify being present in such a country anymore. And, you know, there are more urgent cases in Africa, and off they all go. And it's happened in the last 2 or 3 years. Meanwhile, the indigenous people of the Peruvian Amazon are not any better off because of all these oil exports. They're not getting any money from the government, or haven't been. And meanwhile, so, and then Peru is like this kind of manic depressive country because every 5 years it has wild mood swings and they change government. So they just kicked this last guy out because he really was too corrupt. And, I mean, actually, the guy, Alan Garcia, was the most corrupt president ever seen in the mid-1980s. And then they reelected him in 2006. And he once again proved himself to be extremely corrupt. So they kicked him out again, and they've put in some kind of, you know, left-leaning guy who has greater indigenous and ecological sensitivities, it would seem. And, but, you know, once again, the indigenous people are kind of suspended, and it depends on these different interests that are now kind of world interests. And I don't know, it just seems like kind of inexorable. I mean, I'm still doing this because I don't know how to do anything else at this point. You know, I mean, I also feel like if I kind of threw in the towel and walked out, it just wouldn't be good at all. Mm. You know, I mean, yes, there are other people down there who are trying to do things. That's true. But the situation is getting more and more complicated. And I don't know. You know, when you look at the economic interests in this world and you read the newspapers and, you know, gold and oil and Libya and debt and AAA credit ratings and all of that stuff, you know that if there's lots of gold, lots of oil, lots of resources in a place, that the industrial world is going to go down there and suck it out. And, you know, nobody's talking, I mean, very few people are talking about anything other than growth. And growth means suck those resources. You know, so it's not looking too good either for the Amazon or for its indigenous inhabitants, but that's not news.
Right. Well, just got one more minute or so, and it just you know, I'd love to even hear you say just a tad on how the indigenous folks that you work with are kind of, how do you see them responding to this? Is there resilience? Is there fatalism? Is there a new set, canniness among younger people who are more plugged into the internet but still identify with their traditions? What do you see?
Yeah, you know, one thing that Amazonians are good at, and those with shamanic sensitivities in particular, is transformation, you know, transform into jaguars. Well, a lot of them are working on transforming into gringos at this point. Mm. And gringos and jaguars have a lot in common, you know, top of the food chain, powerful, fearsome, and so forth. So there are a lot of young Amazonian people who are learning to express themselves with computers on the international scene, painting, not just being political activists and having angry speeches into the microphone, but actually, you know, making themselves heard in cool ways. So that's something that's going on, and it's true that the internet opens up all kinds of possible channels that didn't exist before. I mean, just the day after tomorrow, I'll be speaking in Bern, here the capital of Switzerland, before the exhibition of an Amazonian Peruvian painter who married a Swiss woman and who's now exhibiting his visionary ayahuasca art here in the heart of Europe. You know, and getting Europeans interested in Amazonian reality and modified states of consciousness through his painting.
Wonderful. You know, well, we got to leave it there. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
All right. From me and Maja, keep your minds open.